Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behind the badge.
Hi, I'm Paul Listick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain. And welcome to this week's podcast. We're going to start off with a senator who wrote a book called Desk 88, Eight Progressive Senators Who Changed America. I know that's what he wants to talk about, and I promise him we will. But there's too much going on in the world to start there. And so joining me is Senator Sherrod Brown, U.S. Senator from the great state of Ohio. Senator, you join me on Politics Tonight. I welcome you now to my WGN podcast.
Good to be back. You're a busy, full-service kind of guy, so thank you.
Well, part of it, I think, is the government's responsibility, his fault, right? Because you're keeping us busy.
Well, there's that.
So,
right.
Look, within days of us talking now, articles of impeachment will make their way over to the Senate. I want to kind of fast forward to that and basically just ask, I'm sure you're up to date with all that's going on and the question over witnesses. How comfortable are you, as a Democratic senator, that there will be a fair trial one way or another in the Senate? Are Republicans willing to call witnesses?
Well, that's not clear, and so far they have not been. I'm a Democrat, but I also will take an oath this Thursday, administered by the Chief of Justice, that I will do my duty and listen to the evidence. I go into this principally as a juror. I'm not a lawyer, but all of us know that at a trial you have the prosecution, that'd be the House managers, you have the defense, the president's lawyers, then you have witnesses and documents and new evidence come in. And so far, Senator McConnell has said no documents and no new documents and no witnesses. And the public will see that as a sham trial if we don't. So I'm hopeful in the next few days the trial looks like it should start in earnest next Tuesday. We do swearing in and all. Everybody takes an oath tomorrow and Thursday. But the trial should start next week, and I'm hopeful that my colleagues all really do look at this. If the president brings forward witnesses who were in the room, who were there, that exonerate him, I'll vote not guilty. If not, I want to hear what the president has to say in his defense and judge accordingly.
Obviously, Democrats who hear people like Senator McConnell say, I'm working with the White House, and Senator Lindsey Graham, who says, hey, this thing is dead as far as I'm concerned, there's problems with that, because you just said you're about to take an oath of impartiality separate from your U.S. Senate oath. At the same time, there are also Democrats who are pretty much ready to vote to remove him from office as well. Would you say that both sides are wrong to take a position now?
Yeah, nobody should take a position now. I mean, I've made clear my views of President Trump. I think he's the worst president of my lifetime. That doesn't mean just that. Doesn't mean he should be removed. I supported impeachment because he clearly did things that Richard Nixon never even did. He essentially bribed a foreign leader in order to help his own campaign. But that, to me, doesn't rise to the level of removal from office until I hear all the evidence, hear the witnesses, eyewitnesses and ear witnesses, if you will, and hear the president's defense. And we should not make our mind up in either party. None of the 100 of us should make our mind up until we hear that. I would not go quite to the false equivalency that both parties have done it, even though I am critical of Democrats that said it too. When the people that run the trial, the person that ran the trial, Senator McConnell, as the presiding officer of the Senate, as the Senate majority leader, that his putting his thumb on the scales is more problematic than an obscure Democratic senator from New England perhaps doing it. So I picked New England because you and I are in the Midwest. So,
right.
But anyway, I don't defend their saying how they're going to vote either.
Obviously, Democrats want to hear from John Bolton, who seems to say he'll make himself available. Mick Mulvaney, we can give you a list of four or five people. Two questions about that. Number one, Mitch McConnell seems to say, hey, look, all of a sudden, if the Democrats don't find that if we don't go beyond the House record, we're not creating a fair trial. That's just ludicrous because they should have done it in the House. Secondly, would you trade a John Bolton for a Hunter Biden if that was a deal put on the table?
Oh, I would, but I don't. I think that, let me answer the second one first. I don't think that Republicans are going to offer or ask for Hunter Biden, because it almost makes fun of what this trial is about. This trial is not about Joe Biden. It's not about his son. It's not about even a Ukrainian oil company. It's about, did the President of the United States abuse his power two ways? One, by soliciting a bribe from a foreign leader, and second, by absolutely refusing to produce evidence when called upon by another equal branch of government. The other part of the question that when they say it wasn't a fair trial in the House, first, it wasn't a trial, it was an indictment, the same as a prosecutor does in Cook County. But the second part of that is that the House over and over tried to bring witnesses in to get testimony, and the president blocked them from coming. So you can't have it both ways. That the House refused to do witnesses. Well, they didn't. They wanted these witnesses, but the president said no to these witnesses. So it's really a simple thing, Paul, that we want to hear from people who are in the room, because the president says this is hearsay. Well, then let us hear from the ear witnesses and eyewitnesses that are actually there, that can tell us the truth. And if they say convincingly under oath, whatever it is that the president is alleged to do, he didn't do, and they can convince us in compelling testimony, we'll vote not guilty and not remove him. But bring him in. These are the witnesses.
By the way, kudos to you for saying Cook County. You could have said Cuyahoga County, you know.
I could have. And Cuyahoga County.
So, look, crystal balls would tell us that the idea of President Trump being removed is just not going to happen. I mean, it's not going to happen. So, basically, the position of many Republicans has been, let the voters decide in November. And I know that you want to see a Democratic president, but I just have to ask you this question. Because you have people like Rick Wilson, who is a Republican, yet he certainly wants to do everything he can to remove Trump from office. He said on a recent TV show, by the way, if Bernie Sanders is nominated, Trump's going to win 45 states, and I know you're going to attack me for that, he said, but it's just what he sees. My question is this. If the president beats these charges, the president wins re-election, what does that tell you about people of the United States?
Well, he's not going to win re-election. I think he's probably going to beat this charge because there are so many Republicans that never, ever criticize. I mean, let me say one thing about that. I work out in a little gym in the basement of the Capitol almost every morning we're here, and I see a number of Republicans there that talk pretty informally and in the cloakroom or on the floor or committee or whatever, and I increasingly hear Republican senators very, very critical of the president. A number of them think he's a racist. They all think he doesn't tell the truth. Somebody to me said this morning that the president went to the LSU-Clemson game in New Orleans because there was such a big crowd and he thought the whole crowd was there for him. I mean, that tells you a little bit about what they think about this president's ego and incompetence and, frankly, leadership qualities. But then publicly, they're not willing to stand up to him. So I fully expect my colleagues to continue to fail to hold him accountable. But I also think that this will be, even though he will likely be exonerated, and I don't really want to make predictions, but that's what everybody thinks, he still will have a mark against him that almost no American president has had, and that is being impeached. He can say it's partisan, but most presidents, almost no presidents, have been impeached for partisan reasons or any other reason. So it's clear he has that mark against him. That will hurt him in November, along with his betrayal of workers. The fact that he has been on the every time. I mean, the White House looks like a retreat for drug company executives, except on Tuesday and Friday when the White House looks like a retreat for Wall Street executives.
So I know you believe he'll go down in November, but, you know, my thought has always been if the Democrats don't play somewhere in the world of Trump in terms of tactics, it's going to be tough for them. I mean, you have a president who swears and all this kind of stuff that we've never seen a president do, and his supporters love it. You know, the worst word that comes out of Joe Biden's mouth is malarkey. And you have other, you know, when you picture President Trump at a debate, if he chooses to debate, he's questioned that, with whoever the Democratic candidate is there anybody, and I'm not asking for an endorsement, but is there anybody in the current dwindling field that you would say, here's somebody that can stand up to that guy and talk to him the way he needs to be talked to?
Well, if talk to him the way he needs to be talked to is to divide and and say race, make racist comments or call people names or swear. No, nor should they. I really do think that voters increasingly, as Election Day gets nearer, voters are exhausted by the fact that their president's on the front page every day, often calling people names, criticizing his own staff after he appointed them, dividing the country. I think people are reaching a point of exhaustion about this, and I think if the president does those kinds of things at a debate, it will just hurry up that day of enough people being exhausted with him that he will lose. And I think that, but it's clear that the Democrat needs to talk about dignity of work. The Democrat needs to make the contrast that we're the party of workers, that we govern through the eyes of workers, and this president is the party of corporate special interest, and this president has betrayed workers. And I think we can make that case as Democrats increasingly clearly to the public.
And before I turn to the book, last question. You know, the Democrats are all about diversity, and they looked at the broad candidate broad list of candidates, and of course, as you know, it's now dwindled down to basically a bunch of white folks. And I'm just curious, you know, part of my reaction is maybe it's pundits who are talking about that, because look, the support is where the support goes. If it's going to white candidates, that's where the support goes. Or do you get a sense that the DNC has created some problems in terms of the standards they've set, making it tough for other candidates to stay in the race?
Well, I don't know how else the DNC. I'm pretty much a defender of the DNC on this. I don't know what else they could have done. You've got to shrink the field. People said, well, shrink the field. There are too many people on the stage, and now they're saying, well, I don't like who's on the stage. I mean, that's everybody knew that going in. I suppose there could have been one other factor. The two factors were polling numbers and number of contributors. I don't know what other factors we could work, except somebody suggested that they have to have X number of years of service, whether it's military or elective office or something else. But then people would have said, then you're keeping out the boy mayor, or the young mayor of South Bend, or keeping out somebody else. So I don't know how you can do this and please everybody. I'm surprised, frankly, that I really like the three candidates of color that are out of the race. I know Kamala really well. I know Cory probably even better. I like Castro. I've been in Cleveland with him when he was HUD secretary. I'm very disappointed the three of them aren't in. For a whole host of factors, they're not. And I don't know what to say about that, except that was the rules ahead of time. And they aren't, I don't think they're slanted for or against anybody.
And maybe one of them, you may have just named a vice presidential nominee, right?
Could be. That's right. Well, absolutely. It could have been. Could be. It could be Stacey Abrams. Could be a number. It could be Catherine Cortez Masto, a Latina from Nevada. It could be a number of people.
Yeah. Let's talk about Desk 88. You sit at a desk of these 100 desks. I don't know if people think about the resolute desks that in that Senate chamber. You don't exactly walk in on day one and see which one is open and grab one. You picked a desk where all progressives sat, all white males, and that didn't seem to be lost on you. But in many ways, talk a bit about some of the people who sat at the desk, because, look, they were flawed candidates. Hugo Black from Alabama was a member of the KKK. Even Al Gore Sr. voted against civil rights. So it's an interesting progression of people who sat at that desk.
Yeah, almost all the desks in the Senate, the people who sat in it in the past were white males. I mean, the Senate, as you look at any old picture of the Senate, you see, one of the reasons I never romanticized the past is go back to the 1950s and 95 white men and one white woman couldn't pass civil rights. So I don't romanticize the past, but I chose this desk. There are 10 desks left for the freshmen. We choose last when I came here a dozen years ago, and I pulled out the desk drawer of what turned out to be Desk 88. I didn't know anything about this at the time, and I noticed that senators carved their names in desk drawers, and my desk said Black, Alabama, McGovern, South Dakota, Gore, Tennessee, and just Kennedy, no name, no state, no first name, no state. And I asked Ted to come over, Senator Edward Kennedy. He walks over. I said, Ted, which brother's this? And he said, well, it's got to be Bobby's desk because I have Jack's. So I took the desk because of that. I started thinking about the senators who sat there, and all eight of them about whom I wrote, they were all progressives, although they may not have called themselves that. At the end, in the last part of their careers, they were progressive. Some of them got there in a pretty haphazard, zigzaggy way. Some were Some did not have early careers that they later were particularly proud of, but all of them made a progressive contribution to the country, from collective bargaining and labor rights to Social Security to Medicare to clean air laws. So that's why I just thought I ought to write about these senators, because it's a good progressive history of the Senate from the 20s into the 1990s.
Well, I'm completely into history. I mean, I just love this stuff. And I love the fact that you talk about certain desks in the chamber are not assigned. And can you talk about why that is? Why, there was a desk, for example, that belonged to Jefferson Davis. I mean, some great stories.
Yeah, there are about, I think, five desks where they're already predetermined. So the majority leader's desk, so Schumer sits there now. The Republican leader, McConnell, sits there. Schumer sits where the Democratic leader sits. Then there's the Daniel Webster desk, even though Webster represented both New Hampshire and Massachusetts in the House and Senate. That desk is reserved for the senior senator from New Hampshire. Then there's the Henry Clay desk that the senior senator from Kentucky sits, but now it's the junior senator because the senior senator is at the majority leader's desk. And then there's the most interesting, and that is Jefferson Davis's desk, which was where Davis sat when the South seceded, and when he, after they had all left, the Northern troops were bivouacked at the Capitol, and the Secretary of the Senate walked in one day, and a Union soldier was bayoneting Jefferson Davis's desk. And the Secretary of Senate said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Well, Davis was a traitor to our country," which he was, as Robert E. Lee was, as they all were. And he said, "But that desk belongs to the people of the United States." So they rebuilt the desk. They kept a little side panel. They kept the damage in the side panel so you could see where he had begun to bayonet it. And they refurbished the desk, and that's where the senior senator from Mississippi now sits.
I also, listen, if I were a senator, man, the first thing I would do would be to sign the thing. I know you made a bit of a ceremony out of it with your grandkids and stuff. Talk about the importance of it to you and the fact that they had to chase down Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton to say, sign your desks.
Yeah, no, most senators don't sign it until fairly late in their careers. Patrick Leahy from Vermont came here in 1974. He still hasn't signed it, but he said, as he's reading my book, he says, "I'm inspired to do it now." And I just encourage people to sign it with their families, make it a little ceremony. I mean, no press or anything. Just do it in the back room with your family or friends around, which is what I did this year. I didn't feel worthy to sign it until I finished my book, and I thought I'd had some accomplishment in the Senate. Harry Truman was in the Senate about 10 years, and he signed 10 different desks. He moved every year and signed a different desk. One senator said he's not signing it because it's defacing public property. Hubert Humphrey's widow took over his seat when he died, and the parliamentarian told me after all the senators had left on the last day, I believe in 1978, if I have my year right, that Muriel sat on the floor of the Senate, staying there, and then she wrote in front of Humphrey in the desk drawer that she had. She wrote M plus H in front of Humphrey's name. So there are some nice little stories like that. I know most of the public couldn't care less. I didn't even know we were assigned desks until I got elected. But I think it's important to remember that history and use it to talk about, frankly, how important the importance of the role of government, that government has the power to make people's lives better. And I really looked at these eight senators. There were many more that signed it. I chose those eight based on that.
By the way, if I was Muriel, I think I would have given Hubert top billing and put H plus M, but that's me. Can you very quickly, since my audience is sure. so many in Illinois, though it's all over the country, but President Obama, they had to chase him down.
Yeah, Obama, there's a young man named Gary, I'm forgetting his last name, I can't believe that Gary, you might write about him in the book, and that he, during the 08 primaries, he said he went to McCain. At this point, the Republican nominee was pretty certain, but Barack and Hillary, what I called them then, now I call them, the president, President Obama, the three of them were still all in the race, and he tried to get each one of them to sign their desks. And I don't know what happened with McCain. I should have found that out, but he kept chasing them down, and finally he said to Obama, he said, "Senator Obama, you know, one of you is going to be elected president. Would you sign this?" And he didn't get around to it. and he kept handing him a Sharpie to do it. And finally, one day, Obama just walked away, and he went back to the desk, Gary did, and he saw that Obama had written with a Sharpie, Barack Obama. We then, a number of people then, in the clerk's office in the back of the room, in the cloakroom, took the drawer out where Hillary sat and had her sign it in the cloakroom. And so she signed it right after she became Secretary of State.
Yeah, if you won't go to the desk, we'll bring the desk to you.
Yeah, mountain go to Mohammed, right? Well said.
You know, as I said, I'm a sucker for history. I'm so moved. I actually have a presidential collection. I've got some of Lincoln's hair and George Washington's hair, a lot of other things. But so having said that, when you cast a vote, when you sit there, and you're about to do that in an impeachment trial, are you struck by the solemnity of where you sit, where you are?
Thank you for that question. One of the reasons I am struck by the solemnity, I've said that word out loud, that I'm struck by the solemnity of this, is I want to be, because I think this job is so, so important. One of the reasons when I did our Dignity of Work tour in the four early states just a year ago right now and thought about running for president, one of the reasons I didn't is I love the Senate, and I take this job very seriously, and I know if you run for president, nobody's chances early are better than 10%, and I didn't really want to give up my devotion to this job. I'm not trying to sound geeky or better than anybody else, but that's a really important part of this. And so I think it's important. One of the reasons I wrote this was I wanted to continue to be in the moment thinking how important this job is, and that this desk was held by a number of people whom I've never heard of. I wrote about eight of them. One or two of them I knew little or nothing about. But all of them played an important role in things that I care about. Again, collective bargaining and minimum wage and Social Security and Medicare and civil rights and voting rights and all those things. And so I think it's important to always be reminded how important this is, not to have self-importance, but to realize the responsibility of this job, that if you're a member of the Senate, you really need to go all out, because in my state, you have in your state almost 13 million people, in my state 12 million people that depend on it. And I took an oath in January of this year, the same day I signed this desk for my third term, that I would do that.
If you run let me ask this question. It sounds as though when you got the desk, you looked at it and you saw these names, and history struck you. I think of Lin-Manuel Miranda's line, history has its eyes on you. If you had to do it all over again, and or if you are able to, if you serve a fourth term, do you get to switch, like look around and say, I want the desk that somebody in particular had? I mean, can any senator do that and pick a desk?
You do it by seniority. So I am right now 28th in the Senate seniority. So when 27 people above me choose where they want to sit, based on what desks are open, I can't kick somebody out of a desk that's still in the Senate. But I would have wider choice because I'm higher in the seniority list. But I would answer it this way. One, I don't plan to leave this desk because I kind of have an affiliation with it now. And I love where I sit, and I love that I worked on this book. As I said to you in the last interview, I think I worked on this book for 10 years.
Yeah.
So it matters to me. But I was going to answer it this way, that if I could choose one other person to write about, and I didn't want to do that because I didn't want to choose anybody that did not sit at this desk. That was the theme of the book. I would have chosen Humphrey, because Humphrey and Teddy Kennedy were the greatest senators of the last 100 years. And Humphrey was a great senator because he followed sort of an inside-outside strategy. He worked with his colleagues really well on the nuclear test ban treaty, on civil rights, on so many issues addressing poverty and income inequality. But he also worked the public really well to put pressure on his colleagues to make them, get them to do the right thing. And that's why I like what kind of Senator Humphrey was. I don't like what he did as vice president and how he sort of inherited Johnson's war that way, Vietnam War, but that wasn't what he did as a senator, and I would love to have written about him too, but it just didn't work that way.
You're entitled to have volume two. The desk I don't sit at.
Yeah, the desk. That really sounds kind of boring, but anyway.
Well, not really. Not when you talk about Humphrey. At first, I wasn't sure if you meant Muriel or Hubert, but I think I got it.
Yeah, I think you know.
And by the way, and this I'm not remembering because you know I've read your book cover to cover, is there anybody who signed more than one desk because they've returned to the Senate?
Yes. Well, as I said, Truman signed 10 desks.
Okay.
Just because every time he moved, we get the chance to move every 2 years. and I have actually moved my place, but they moved the desk with me.
Well, that's what I thought. I thought the desk goes.
Bolted down, but many just move. Most of my colleagues never paid attention to their desks. Some of them have never looked at who signed it, believe it or not. Many of them now are looking because I've made a little presentation. Many of my colleagues have read the book, or at least tell me they've read the book. Many of my colleagues also know that senators often don't write the books that their names are on.
Right.
And I don't understand the ego of wanting to write a book, have your name on a book when you didn't really write it. By the way, I encourage Illinois senior senator, Senator Durbin, to write a book because he is a beautiful writer. My wife's a Pulitzer Prize winner. She loves Durbin's writing. We've seen essays he's personally written, and he's very, very good. And so any constituents of his in Illinois should write him a letter and say, Senator Durbin, when you're coming out with your book, whatever his book is going to be, but he's a very good writer. But I'm surprised that my colleagues haven't looked at their desks, but most haven't. And so most will sign it when they leave. I assume some, because of my book now and just the discussions we've had about them with colleagues, people come up and say stuff to me. I assume a number of them will sign them fairly soon. And most senators don't sign multiple desks. They just sign one.
Well, if I ever get back to Washington and get in the Senate chamber, I'll tell you what, I'm one of those that would love the opportunity to just look at some desks and see those signatures, because
sure.
I think it's so powerful.
Yeah, I'll take you on the floor if you're around and I'm around, you won't be able to, you won't be able to wander around and look at desks, but I can. I can take you to do that.
So. I'll let you do the dirty work.
Yeah.
My guest is Senator Sherrod Brown, U.S. Senator from Ohio, serving his third term. The book, you got to read it, Desk 88, Eight Progressive Senators Who Changed America. If you like history, you'll get it when you read this book. Senator Sherrod Brown, thank you. Appreciate your time.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thank you. Enjoy doing it.
Well, and if I now were to ask you, what do you think you've been listening to? I can tell you what you wouldn't say. You wouldn't say, well, that must be Handel's Messiah. That's about the last thing you might say, because how could the Messiah sound so cool, so jazzy, so gospel-y, well, that's what's going to happen this weekend at the Auditorium Theater for the 15th year in a row, something I've attended now for many years with two people who become dear friends starring in this thing, and I love talking to them about this every year. Too Hot to Handle. Get it, right? The Jazz Gospel Messiah at the Auditorium Theater. Joining me now, two of the stars, two of the three singing leads up front, Rod Dixon, Alfreda Burke. Thank you guys both for joining me and break legs on this coming weekend's performances.
Thank you so much, Paul. Thank you for having us.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Rod, it's always in Chicago over Martin Luther King Junior weekend. It does. I know you get to Detroit, so we get you on Martin Luther King weekend, but that has to have special meaning for you guys in terms of the tribute and the power.
Yes. It's important to really amplify the beloved community that the King talked about, and that we look at each other and find this common denominator, what it means to be in a democratic republic, a sense of democracy, a sense of being together, a free society. And he really, really did stress, we are each other's brothers. We are our brother's keepers from the scriptures. And so that's why Martin Luther King is so important. And Too Hot to Handle represents an amalgamation of all those different genres that include so many different ethnicities. And so that sense of diversity and inclusion is so real and powerful during the King holiday. And the show really represents that. And the city of Chicago just puts on a great show over the weekend.
And Alfreda, you know, listen, when I first came to it, like everybody else, I'm thinking, I'm not really into classical music, the Messiah, I'm not sure I can handle this. That was my first thought. And now, as I've said, I've been there for, I don't know, 8, 9 years, whatever it's been, and I keep coming back.
Wow.
And indeed, in fact, I remember I bring guests with me sometimes. A few years ago, I brought our lieutenant governor, Sheila Simon, who 10 minutes into it turned to me and said, I got to tell you, Paul, when you invited us to this, I didn't really want to see it. And it has exceeded every expectation I had. And that was only 10 minutes into it. Who had the idea, if you remember, for saying we need to take the Messiah and we need to make it lovable by everybody?
Well, that was Marin Alsup, who commissioned the piece in 1992. and performed it first in 1993. She went to Bob Christensen and Gary Anderson and said, how can we reimagine Handel's Messiah and make it more accessible to a wider audience and demographic? And so they came up with all of these wonderful styles. So they do maintain the Baroque style, the classic style, if you want to think of it that way. And then they also began to move in the jazz, gospel, blues, rock, reggae, fusion genres. And there's even more that people just pick them out every year because it does evolve. And so it is a piece for everybody, all ages, a wide audience, and the audience participates as well. And the music reflects that. It's, you know, you were talking about Dr. King, the diversity is also found in music and on the stage as you look and see the cultures. Everybody's represented in the audience as well as on the stage. And that orchestra, that full big band, that jazz combo, 100-person choir, it was actually exceeding 100 these days. And then you have Therese Foley and Suzanne Acton on the podium. So it is a piece of social justice, beloved community, inclusion, diversity, and a piece of hope. It's very inspiring and uplifting.
And Rod, we got to stop and give a special shout out to the pianist, Alan Waddell. I mean, he's, oh my God. I sort of wait every year for his, because there are certain musicians that get their improvisation moment. And when his comes, you'll just sit back. Do you know what he's about to look? The year the Cubs won the World Series, he played Go Cubs Go, which I'm still taking credit for. And because I told you and you told him.
Yes.
But I'm just curious. Do you sit there? Do you know what he's going to do? Or Rod, do you sort of go, who knows what he's got up his sleeve?
Well, the way Alvin came about this conversation is it's really derived from his classical training and backdrop from University of Michigan. He's a double piano. He's a piano major with a master's degree and a minor in voice. So he knows vocal literature, both in terms of classical music as well as popular music. And so he has a wide girth, as we say, a wide span of repertoire in his head. But here's what they've done recently in the last couple of years. They've had these write-ins where people were sending, you know, what do you want Alvin to play? And so he puts together a cadre of numbers that the public chooses in Chicago.
Yes.
And then he decides to put them away with Marion Hayden, our drummer Dave. And they come up with this interesting conversation because the people of Chicago speak out and say, we want to hear this year. And so that's been a very interesting and wonderful development in the last couple of years. And Alvin is just, as they say, he's a phenom.
I'm going to see it all at a dinner the night before, so I'll come with a list of songs. I'll pass it over to him so he can be ready. Now, Alfred, I got to ask you this question. I mean, look, you and Rod are married. I don't know if I said that up until now, but you all are married and have been for many years, both living in the theater world. And look, you are incredible. Everybody's incredible. But you got to admit with me, your husband kind of brings the house down from time to time. What is it? So I'm going to ask you the question. What is it about Rod's performance and voice that just has people on their feet every time he seems to open his mouth?
Rod has a certain energy and spirit that he brings to the table. And his preparation, his abilities, his gifts, but also his passion rings through. So whenever he does something, he prepares to the nth degree, and then he brings his heart and soul to it. So he is going to bring the house down. And this piece was written with Thomas Young in mind, who is a tenor, He is just amazing with a body of work in jazz as well as classical music. So, and Rod is that same way. You know, he can sing all of the genres and styles seamlessly, but yet be classically trained and have that wonderful strong foundation in classical music and still singing it today, singing, you know, all of these genres seamlessly with that solid foundation of technique. Yeah. But so when you and then you think about the text that he has to sing, Handel's Messiah, I mean, who wouldn't be excited to sing these scriptures about the Messiah, the prophecy, birth, life, death, resurrection of Jesus Christ. And so he's sort of like the voice of John the Baptist. And he opens with the comfort ye, and every valley shall be exalted, every hill and mountain made low, the crooked straight, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed. So he is just the person to deliver those words. and you believe it. You really feel it when he's singing.
Rod, you see why I asked your wife that question?
Yeah.
Because you would have probably just said, oh, pshaw. But I couldn't do that. Hey, Rod, there's something else special about this event that's happened, I think, over the last period of years. And that is a special audience who gets to view this, even though they're not within the auditorium theater with the rest of us.
Yeah, Paul, you know, we didn't see this coming. 15 years ago, when we started in Chicago, we thought it would be perfect for Chicago. Brett Battison brought it in from Michigan Opera Theater and Rackham Symphony Choir with Suzanne. But just about 7-8 years ago, someone from Christian Reformed Church had been watching this show and been coming. And John Zeister and Jim McMillan and those guys had been coming, or Kyle Olson from Elmhurst. And they said, hey, we would love to stream this to the prisons. And we said, let's do it. And next thing I know, as of this year, I think this is our fourth year. And we're streaming to the Juvenile Detention Center. We're streaming to all of Cook County, the prisons in Cook County. And we're streaming to Angola in Louisiana. And our Freedom Night visit the maximum security prison in Angola to see the gentleman there and to speak to them before the show was streamed there. So now we have this platform that they can see the show, touch us, we can eat together, we can talk about their cases. The children in the detention center, we've been going to the Adopt a Pod for the last two or three years at the Juvenile Detention Center. And so it has really been a very beautiful, a wonderful pilgrimage, because what they do is that at the Adopt a Pod, we can't bring anything with us in. And so we go in and sing a cappella, and we talk with the young men. They're, you know, up to 18 before they're mainstream, and they have their cases coming up. And we try to reach them, and they serve food. And then at Too Hot to Handle, they bring the parents in. And sometimes that's the only time the mothers and fathers get a chance to spend time with their sons. And I think Alfreda can amplify this, that the director there had talked about what happened with some of the mothers who are listening to the show, because they're hearing this religious text and they're crying with their child who's not adult yet, but it's had an effect on them. And he said, it's a beautiful thing when you can present them a glimmer of hope, a sense of belonging, and that people still care for them, and that life still has a chance to elevate them to their humanity of becoming what they always wanted to become, a second and third chance. So that's what's been going on the last 3 or 4 years.
That is beautiful. Alfreda, you want to add to that?
Yeah, the important part about the Adopt-A-Pod program is that we go in to Cook County Juvenile Temporary Detention Center, you know, every other month, approximately, and we sit with these residents, these young people, and we talk to them, we listen to them. We break bread with them. We pray with them. They ask for prayer. And it's with Elmhurst Christian Reformed Church, who has partnered with the Auditorium Theater in 4 years of live streaming. This will be the fourth year. And they've been coming for 6 years. And the first, you know, the second year that they attended, they were like, we need to get this into correctional facilities and share this with those that are imprisoned. And it'll give them hope. It'll, you know, uplift their spirits. It'll let them know, as Rod said, that people care. And that's the biggest message, to spread love, inclusion, to give a sense of hope, and to encourage these young people as they, you know, are being transitioned and transformed, and, you know, they're being rehabilitated. And then, and sometimes they're wrongfully accused, and they're in there, and they look at you and they say, thank you so much for coming. And you don't know if their parents can make it or family members can make it out. But yes, when the live streaming is happening with Too Hot to Handle, Director Stewart has given us feedback and said that people were weeping and crying, and that it really was impactful to their audiences. So we're really happy, you know, because we have somewhat of a relationship after going to Adopt a Pod for 3 years. We feel like we know these young people, and it just really matters for us. This work is very important work. So we're very pleased that Too Hot to Handle is being live streamed to these prisons and facilities.
Well, and I wanted people to know about it because, again, you know, you do a lot of performing. You're in a lot of shows. Rod, I'm always seeing, you know, on Facebook, various concerts you're all doing. And I think that's wonderful. But when you have a project like this that lets you, you know, help change the world and help make people better, I just, you know, there just isn't a lot of art that can do that in this kind of hands-on way. And I just, I think on behalf of society, I thank both of you for the incredible work that you're doing. The Too Hot to Handle concert takes place, the Jazz Gospel Messiah, give you the full title, at the Auditorium Theater. There is a student performance on Friday, this Friday at 12:30. But on Saturday, January 18th, it's at 7:30 p.m. Saturday at 7:30. Sunday, January 19th at 3 p.m. January 19th at 3 p.m. In fact, those are the two performances you should think about. Saturday, January 18th, 7:30. Sunday, 3 p.m. I've got that right. Right, guys?
Yes.
All right. Friday is a little early. I think Friday starts at 11.
Oh, okay.
11
so,
in the morning.
Okay.
Yeah,
and that again, it's a student concert. I want people to come have fun with me on Saturday night at 7:30. And on Sunday, when I think every church in the entire city clears out and comes to you guys at 3 p.m.
Yeah.
You can get tickets at auditoriumtheater.org. Theater is spelled the proper British way, T-R-E at the end of that, auditoriumtheater.org. It's your chance to see Rod Dixon, Elfrieda Burke, and a cast of hundreds that fill that stage and fill that huge theater with a sound like you've never heard before. Trust me, you see it once, you'll become a hottie just like me and return year after year after year. Roderick Dixon, Elfrieda Burke, I love you. I thank you guys, and I'll see you at Too Hot to Handle.
All right.
Thank you, Paul. We love you, too.
All right. Bye-bye, guys.
Bye.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's P-A-U-L-L-I-S-N-E-K. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more Insider Scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.